In the past few lectures, I've emphasized how industrialization, urbanization, commercialized agriculture, big food business, transport, advertising, and imperialism, and a wave of immigrants all combined to dramatically revolutionize what people ate. Today, we will look at the ways World War I changed how civilians eat, along with later events of the early 20th century. A precondition for the role of food in mechanized warfare was simply the expansion of agriculture and ranching, both of which had become big business. Vast stretches of prairie had been planted with wheat for the first time, and wheat production tripled in the last decades of the 19th century. In that time, farming had become thoroughly mechanized. Improved strains of wheat were grown, and such a surplus was produced that one-third of the wheat grown in the U.S. was exported. The United States became literally the breadbasket for much of the world. At the same time, huge cattle ranches were producing beef that was shipped by train to slaughterhouses in Chicago and Kansas City. Fresh beef became a major food staple for most people for the first time in history. The price of food dropped dramatically. In the early years of the century, Americans were extremely well-fed, especially by comparison to the rest of the world. And it was largely this abundance that made the U.S. absolutely crucial to the war effort in World War I. When that war broke out, and it only became a large-scale conflict because European nations had joined into these alliance systems that put Austria and Germany on one side and Russia, France, and Britain on the other. But the U.S., if you'll remember, was isolationist in this period and had no intention of getting involved in the conflict. Germany mobilized very quickly and invaded Belgium, along with the intention of sweeping down into France, and the two countries basically dug in trenches and fought for several years along the Western Front. Now, the Belgians were right in the middle of this all. And by this point, they were largely dependent on imports for food, and so they were really cut off. German U-boats prevented ships from coming in, and German troops ate everything they could get their hands on in Belgium. So it looked like the Belgians would starve to death. Until one particular individual, living in London at the time, decided to mount a rescue operation entirely on his own volition and without any pay. You know this person. This is Herbert Hoover. And he convinced the Germans that since the U.S. was neutral, he should be allowed to send food into Belgium. He also, of course, had to convince the British. They were afraid that anything sent over would be eaten by German soldiers. So finally, a deal was arranged, and Hoover organized a food relief program for 10 million people. Every single day, the shipping, the distribution, the cooking of food, they even gave children these super nutrient-rich cookies. And this actually worked for several years. Until the U.S. entered the war. Unrestricted submarine warfare hit many U.S. trading vessels, and then finally the Lusitania, which had U.S. citizens aboard. A perfectly logical choice for Woodrow Wilson was to appoint Hoover as he's really practically the dictator of the government's wartime food administration. In 1917, Wilson had passed through Congress the Lever Act, or the Food and Fuel Control Act, which basically gave the government complete control of prices, transport of food to prevent hoarding and shortages, and a careful control of all exports. And perhaps most importantly, Hoover was given control over this huge propaganda machine that was meant to convince people to eat less food so it could be sent abroad to the soldiers and the Allies. And interestingly, rather than use coercion, they described this as a patriotic duty to do your share. Food conservation, in fact, was nicknamed Hooverizing. And he encouraged people to go back to simple food, simple clothes, and simple pleasures. They also promoted Wheatless Mondays and Meatless Tuesdays, and the campaign was so successful that there was a 15% voluntary surplus of wheat and beef that was sent directly to the fronts. At home, they tried promoting whale meat for a while and horse steaks. That didn't catch on. And the idea was that wheat and beef were considered more nutritious at the time. So ultimately, people back at home were told to eat more poultry and cornmeal rather than beef and wheat. And people were also encouraged to grow their own food. These were the first victory gardens right here in World War I. Now, what soldiers actually ate in the trenches is equally interesting. They started out with a lot, with about 10 ounces of meat, 8 ounces of vegetables, and they figured out that they were getting about 3,574 calories, which is what the nutritional scientist said is essential for energy requirements in fighting. Eventually, they have to reduce that. They reduce it to 6 ounces of meat, and finally, meat only every third day. And that happens because the blockades become a lot more effective. The rations also consisted of what they called bully beef. It's a canned corned beef and bread and biscuits. They have canned pea soup and something called McConaughey rations, which is a kind of Irish stew that you could actually heat in the can itself. But normally they would actually just eat it cold because, you know, if you lit a fire, you risk the enemy seeing you and then you might be shelled. And in fact, that's why you never light 3 cigarettes on a match. Well, when the war ended, Hoover realized, and remember, he never took any pay for this. He insisted that they continue this aid, even to the Germans, who he thought would never become allies in the future if they were allowed to perish. So the Allies, in the end, really prevented it. And of course, he was right, you know, but food did get to Europe in care packages. And in fact, they even went to Bolshevik Russia, despite the obvious, you know, ideological differences. And of course, all the food industries that had retooled to make these quick and convenient and shelf-stable foods for the war effort, they weren't going to just discontinue these lines. So after the war, they simply marketed them to civilians. And army rations in cans are a good example of this. The post-war period was also relatively prosperous. Brand-name, nationally distributed products flourished. They mounted huge advertising campaigns. They developed attractive packaging to sell products, and typically it's now in small units, so you can buy a week's worth rather than, you know, a 50-pound sack of flour. And foods that were originally designed for the war increasingly are marketed with this idea of convenience in mind. More and more people were working outside the home or couldn't afford domestic servants to do these lengthy preparations, so quick and easy became a serious marketing angle, especially for working women. Processed food also, to this generation, seemed more hygienic. You know, a can of condensed milk that's pasteurized can just sit on the shelf rather than fresh milk, which of course goes bad eventually. Or you have, you know, a Campbell's soup in a can that you just pour out and add water and heat up. That seems very convenient. Now, underlying all of these changes was the fact that more people were now living and working in cities. In fact, by 1920, more than half Americans were living in cities with populations over 2,500. And there were a lot more big cities, too. So there was a demand not only for more food, but of more diverse kinds of food that could be prepared quickly by people who were very busy. By 1900, the food processing industry accounted for 20% of the nation's manufacturing and increasingly fewer and fewer food giants. We're talking about big corporations controlled the supply of food because much of it was now, in fact, canned or frozen or shipped from far away out of season. And the tendency for small businesses to be pushed out also had a lot to do with new food laws. There was the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906. And then the compulsory pasteurization of milk was required. That's 1908. Serious muckraking efforts to clean up the meat packing industry. In fact, if you think of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, that's right about this era. And all this meant that complying with federal regulations and buying the latest machinery, and you combine that with the need to advertise on a large scale, it meant that by the 1920s, a few big companies were dictating, for the most part, what people ate. The Nabisco, the National Biscuit Company, basically just pushed out the smaller competitors. Heinz completely dominated the condiments business. Campbell's Soup, you know, sold all the soup. And much the same happened with meat packing. There's a few businesses. It's Armour, Swift, and Hormel, but they pretty much dominate. Post-cereal business started buying up other companies, including Jell-O, and they become General Foods. And by the 1920s, food manufacture was the largest industry in the country, surpassing even steel and textiles in the amount of money invested. So not only was much of the food people ate highly processed, but they actually began to eat more. And I think maybe for the first time in human history, a whole population, rather than just a few elite people, was either very well fed or actually overfed. Food was cheap, and a stout body actually came to be associated with affluence. You know, think of the president at the time, Taft. And newly arrived immigrants could, of course, afford more food than was ever possible back in their homeland. After 1924, when the big influx of immigrants stopped, and more children were born in the U.S. rather than abroad, slowly these populations became assimilated. They picked up eating habits from their classmates. They began to eat things like American breakfast cereals, processed and canned foods, because of course these things were cheap and they were marketed to them. Retailing also changed in this period. Most food before that time was sold in small, privately owned shops, especially in cities. You know, you'd have one butcher here and a fruit vendor and a fishmonger, and you basically, you know, walk from store to store in order to shop. And it's actually very convenient. You know, if you come off the subway on your way home, you pass all these different shops, you buy whatever you want, you shop every day, but only for a few minutes. And eventually you come to know the vendors, right? You can ask for certain things. You get a kind of personal service. If you don't like something, you tell the person right there. Well, all of that began to change as supermarkets began to buy out small operations. They can buy produce and meat at much lower prices because, of course, they buy in huge quantities. And because they have their own distribution systems, they can buy food from much further afield, and they can consistently sell food at cheaper prices than these small grocers. In 1912, the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, or as you know, A&P, opened its first all-purpose grocery. And this is opposed to the earlier tea shops that they had for quite a while. In 1916, the Piggly Wiggly opened what is usually regarded as the first modern grocery store, which is to say they had aisles with shelves and they were lined with pre-packaged items that had prices right on them. So no one had to weigh anything, no one had to wrap anything, you didn't have to wait in line to be helped by a clerk. And the idea was that speed and efficiency and low prices will bring in shoppers, and this meant big grocery chains really push out the mom-and-pop stores. Refrigerators also finally became practical devices. Once they replaced the huge compressors that, you know, were filled with ammonia and sulfur dioxide and chemicals that explode, but that happens with the discovery of a chlorinated fluorocarbon compound, what are called CFC, or Freon 12. And that happens in 1931. And as a result of refrigeration, fresh fruit, vegetables, dairy products, those become ordinary staples in every household. And because everything was prepackaged with readily identifiable brand names, people could do much larger shopping at one time. They could stock up the pantry and refrigerator for an entire week or even longer with a whole variety of foods that would last indefinitely. So by the 1920s and 30s, there are things like Kool-Aid, popsicles, Velveeta, candy bars like Baby Ruth and Milky Way and Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, as well as a slew of, let's call them junk foods, right? Lay's potato chips, Twinkies. And there were also household convenience items like Pyrex dishes that you could take right from the fridge and put into the oven. In 1919, there's also the KitchenAid mixer. But perhaps just as important were new cookbooks. The Joy of Cooking came out in 1931, and along with the cookbooks made by the manufacturers themselves, of course, they explain how to use all these new products, you know, how to use, say, Campbell's cream of mushroom soup in a casserole, or how to make a mock apple pie with Ritz crackers. But clearly, people were learning to cook foods that were not only completely different from what their forebears ate, but things that, in fact, that had never been eaten by humans before. Some companies like General Mills created their own home economists too. I mean, these are completely fictional characters, and in fact, they change over time. Their haircuts change and things. But theirs was, of course, Betty Crocker, and she explained how to use these products. A whole slew of new ladies' magazines like the Ladies' Home Journal and Good Housekeeping. These touted the wonderful benefits of food processing. And of course, they always hired a medical doctor to dispense nutrition information. Now, the discovery of the calorie and the role of vitamins in nutrition was equally important to this whole scenario. Again, this was largely the result of research done in World War I on how to feed soldiers more efficiently. And the government was rightfully afraid that malnourished troops would lose the war. So they started sponsoring research into what really constitutes a healthy, well-balanced diet. And of course, as you know, the government has been defining nutritional guidelines ever since. Nutritional scientists had already identified proteins and carbohydrates and fats and how the body makes use of them. And then they figured out a way to measure kilocalories. And that's largely the work of Wilbur Atwater, who figured out how many calories are used in various activities using this a respiration calorimeter. And it's a big sort of airtight tank in which you could accurately measure metabolism. I mean, it's just basic physiology. But to this day, when we think about foods, when we compare them and rate them, it's almost entirely in terms of calories. And from this simple perspective, food is just fuel, nothing more. You know, there may be a few vitamins and minerals, but ultimately food is number of calories. Now, understanding vitamin A and B, that's discovered before World War I, C and D within a decade after the war. But that meant that the health conscious people had a firm scientific base, not just health food quacks peddling their breakfast cereals and peanut butter. Alongside this was the development of home economics as an academic discipline, and one that was considered suitable for women to enter, which was partly about domestic science, cooking and household management, but increasingly nutrition and what we would call food science and chemistry plays a part. And this was basically how nutrition information spread. It eventually becomes a topic taught in public schools. Even the organization of the kitchen becomes a serious topic. Frederick W. Taylor, the guru of scientific management, or what was called Taylorism, created a system that was intended to make the workplace more efficient by minimizing having workers walk back and forth unnecessarily. And the idea is to minimize labor, basically by rationalizing space. And eventually they applied to kitchens too. They designed them so that the food could be taken from the fridge and placed on the stove without really moving too much, so that the least possible labor could be expended to get the task done by doing all these kind of motion time studies. Not that all this nutritional science and scientific study made quackery obsolete, and perhaps the strangest fad of the early 20th century was called Fletcherizing, named for this guy Horace Fletcher, and he, a strange figure who lived in a 13th century palazzo on the Grand Canal in Venice, but he in fact did get endorsements from all sorts of scientists. Fletcherizing meant to thoroughly chew food until it's completely broken down, and he seemed to think that something at the back of the mouth was important in digestion. So that you couldn't thoroughly digest food unless it was chewed and it had no taste and then it was sort of involuntarily swallowed. And that takes about 100 chews per mouthful. And along with that, he advocated eating much less protein. So it seems like you would necessarily be eating less if you have to spend all this time chewing. But he was enormously popular. A lot of people took his advice seriously. And eating this way was supposed to cure you of dyspepsia and gout and a whole slew of other ailments that obviously many people suffered from overeating. Fletcher also performed stunts like running up and down the Washington Monument or skating for hours on end or lifting larger weights than athletes could handle. And he was a millionaire, so he could fund scientists to support his theories with research. And in fact, you know, Upton Sinclair was a follower, as well as Henry James and his brother William, the philosopher. Anyway, the important thing about all this new nutritional science, quack or legitimate, is that food corporations began to advertise their products with explicit health claims. Citrus growers could scare people by saying they had to get their vitamin C every day, so you better eat an orange. Or better get your glass of juice in the morning. Pasta manufacturers claimed that vitamin-rich pasta contains necessary nutrients, and they formed the National Macaroni Institute to promote scientific research and publish their studies. In fact, they even tried to get Friday designated as National Macaroni Day. In the 20s, asparagus was relatively unknown in the U.S. until the Canners League of California ran a campaign to promote their vitamin-rich vegetable. And that's how both of these previously ethnic foods were introduced to the nation as a whole. And I think the most ingenious stratagem was by the spinach growers, who paid for not just the ads, but actually a whole cartoon of this guy, Popeye the Sailor, whose iron-enriched muscles, you know, bulge every time he gulps down, notice, a can of spinach. And he was introduced in 1929. And in the 1930s, spinach consumption rose 33%. And apparently that saved the whole industry. Cereal producers were, of course, the most successful at making health claims, as they still are today. You know, a 1920s Grape Nuts ad read this: "Are you bringing up your children properly? It is possible to give children as much food as they can possibly eat, and still their little bodies can be undernourished? Well, to the rescue comes, of course, Grape Nuts, which contains iron, calcium, phosphorus, and other minerals that are taken right up as vital food by the millions of cells in the body." Fleischmann's yeast actually made an even stronger claim. They were afraid that since no one was baking at home anymore, they might go under, so they started promoting yeast as a vitamin-rich food that you could spread on bread or mix into drinks. And they argued that 2 or 3 cubes of fresh yeast a day are good for you. This is what they say: eat it at your desk. Ask for it at noontime for your lunch place. So even manufacturers of chocolate bars started advertising their products as vitamin-packed and a quick source of energy. Well, the giant milk distributors like Sealtest and Borden's eventually formed a national organization to promote milk. It's a daring lobby that basically gets legislation passed for national nutritional guidelines that suggested at this time that people drink a whole quart of milk a day. And I'm not talking about just growing children, but adults also. And milk consumption, as a result, rose to over 800 pounds per capita in 1925. That seems astronomical to me. But they also paid for research at universities, especially Wisconsin, right, the dairy industry, to figure out a way to enrich milk with vitamin D. So it's much better for you now, presumably. Americans were also basically advertised into eating a diet consisting mostly of white bread and milk. And the irony, of course, is that the manufacturers never mentioned the fact that the nutrients and vitamins were destroyed with processing, which was well known by scientists, and not just not advertised with all the health claims. Now, aligned with this new interest in health was probably one of the stranger experiments the United States has tried as a nation. We're talking about Prohibition. The temperance movement was growing steadily since the latter 19th century, with groups like the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and lobbying pressure became so great that the 18th Amendment eventually makes alcohol illegal. And that lasted 13 years. The intent was to reduce crime and poverty and ultimately to improve the nation's health. Of course, they ignored the fact that use or abuse of alcohol was a symptom, not the cause of poverty. And they assumed that if a family's income wasn't being spent on drink, then it would be spent on good, decent food. And of course, people found ways to get it illegally, right? They made their own bathtub gin, which sometimes would be poisonous, or they would rely on bootleggers or visit speakeasies, or they'd engage in rum running, which is, you know, bringing alcohol over the frozen lakes from Canada. Organized crime basically stepped in to supply the alcohol that people wanted. It's very funny that alcohol was allowed for sacramental purposes. And apparently in New York, there was a sudden wave of people either actually or claiming to be Jewish so they could purchase sacramental wine. In fact, Mayor LaGuardia, New York's mayor at the time, said, "It's impossible to tell whether prohibition is a good thing or a bad thing. It has never been enforced in this country." And people, of course, began drinking more hard liquor because beer and wine are much harder to transport, so you want to have it concentrated. Liquor was smuggled in by gangs. There were only 1,500 federal officers employed to stop it, and they had to monitor every single inch of coastline, every border. And of course, that was impossible. So ironically, it actually increased crime. And not just smuggling. We're talking homicide, for example, doubled from about 5 per 100,000 to about 10. Crime in general rose because prohibition also destroyed jobs. All these local breweries, all the bars closed, wineries, the vast majority of them folded. And the ones that survived either had to, well, the breweries, of course, marketed malted milk. The wineries sold grape juice. But the majority of them really couldn't survive during Prohibition. So the prosperity and completely unregulated wild speculation of the 20s simply could not last. Agriculture was actually hit hard even before the stock market crash of 1929, and it had a lot to do with too much food on the market and low prices. And then what happens is a series of terrible droughts, people losing their farms, and then the failure of the banks and people's savings were wiped out. The worst drought hit in 1934 and 1936, the Dust Bowl. Thousands of farmers just quit. Others, like those in Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, just picked up, headed for California, and ended up as migrant laborers, either picking fruit and living in shacks, or sometimes even just camped outside. The Great Depression affected workers too. This is the highest unemployment rate in history. We're talking in the US, 13 million people were without jobs. That's 1 in 5. And the disaster forced the government to become much more directly involved in the food supply in ways that it had never been before. This was Roosevelt's New Deal. And essentially, it was a series of ad hoc emergency measures designed to deal with the crisis. But it also really changed the role of government in regulating food policy permanently. For the first time, government was forced to take control of the economy, and especially the supply of food. The Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933 enabled the government to purchase food directly from farmers. And it also paid farmers, this sounds weird, to reduce their acreage in order to prevent prices from falling even further. The Farm Credit Act also helped farmers refinance their mortgages, or farmers would be lent money so they could hold on to their crops until the prices improved. The government really bought up surpluses. In other words, they began to tamper with supply and demand economics, bringing an end to free market economy. And that's a legacy that remains for good and ill right down to this day. The New Deal also began food subsidy programs, which gave surpluses to schools and to poor families, things like flour and dried beans, canned meats and vegetables, peanut butter, cereal. Soup kitchens were also set up in all major cities, and a new idea was food stamps. They're handed out, and you can use them in place of money. And a whole slew of new public works programs were designed to help people in the short term and, of course, the long term, too. And naturally, these handouts meant that more people were either eating the mass-produced food distributed by the government or buying things in grocery stores where they could use these food stamps. So, ironically, this was actually a good time to be in the food industry. Cheaper, more economical, more convenient foods, things that are prepackaged, they, strangely enough, flourish right through the Depression. To give you an idea, mass-produced white bread in 1939 was valued at $514 million, while bread privately baked was only worth $20 million. 7.2 billion pounds of white bread were produced compared to 1.7 of other baked goods. By 1934, 39 million pounds of frozen food was purchased, and a decade later, it was 600 million. Now, you'd think in a depression, people would prepare food more themselves because it's cheaper. You put in the labor yourself rather than pay someone else to do it. But exactly the opposite happens. Cheap, subsidized white bread, canned food, even prepackaged junk foods and convenience foods, those become staples. And strangely, also, more people ate out more often. Cheaper establishments, especially cafeterias and lunch counters, which were run as chains, or even lunch counters in department stores, most of which had a soda fountain that would be operated by a soda jerk, or even cheaper places like Horn and Hardart Automat, and that featured these little compartments with glass windows, and you'd put your money in, and then the door opens. And the whole idea is speed and efficiency, and you don't need to wait in line or deal with surly ladies slopping out food. Another thing is diners also boomed in the 30s. An estimated 4,000 of them operated in 1932. And they're a really uniquely American phenomenon. It's a place that's open late into the night. You can order anything you want, any time of day. It's quick, cheap, substantial, no frills, endless cups of coffee. And the ironic part is, of course, at first, a diner is a mobile diner, right? It's mostly in cities, but they're meant to move around. They eventually become a permanent, you know, sort of mortar and brick establishment in the suburbs. And the space also, interestingly, encourages eating alone at a counter. That's a unique phenomenon. But all of this presages what will happen in the next generation with the advent of fast food. And that's our next topic for discussion.